When New Yorker Adam Gopnik went to France, he discovered how the French appetite for eating well and the rituals they include with preparing and enjoying a proper meal can make every day a pleasure, wherever you are. He joins us in just a moment to explain why the table comes first in France. And later in the hour, tour guide friends from Portugal provide us a taste of their food culture. From hearty stews in chilly mountain villages, to seafood on a sun-drenched patio by the sea, and why codfish is still at the heart of the Portuguese palate. We're joined today by Adam Gopnik. He's a New Yorker writer, and he spent 5 years living in France with his family and learning firsthand about the importance of eating in the French family. His new book, The Table Comes First, Family, France, and the Meaning of Food, explains what he took out of that experience. Adam, thanks for joining us.
Pleasure to be here, Rick.
Adam, I love this quote that you say, what goes on the table is not as important as what goes on around the table. And when we think about the difference between American eating and French eating, I'm surprised that the stress wouldn't be on the fancy cooking.
Well, I think that that's a kind of false way of seeing what makes France an interesting place to live in and to eat in. Fancy cooking is something that grew up in France, of course. But the great bulk of the cooking that goes on in France, like the great bulk of the cooking that goes on in America, isn't fancy. It tends to be the plain food we prepare every night. And what really, I think, begins to distinguish what we love about French food, why people go to France so much, is the cultural spirit, the rituals, the feeling that passes around the table just as much as the things we choose to eat.
I love that the ritual of eating is just as important. And in France, there really is a ritual of eating. How would you compare that with eating in the United States?
Well, you know, somebody once said, maybe it was me, that the most valuable thing in food 200 years ago was protein. That was the most expensive thing. Now the most valuable and expensive thing in food is time, having the time to prepare food, having the time to enjoy food. One of the French rituals that is very alien to the United States, of course, is the long lunch. I remember when I was living in France, I had terrible difficulties being a kind of puritanical, a high-energy, impatient New Yorker, absorbing the idea that if you sat down to lunch with somebody, you were expected to have dinner, three courses, and a bottle of wine. And I'm one of those people on whom wine in the middle of the afternoon seems to be a totally different food or intoxicant than it is at night. I don't know if you have those feelings, Rick. If I drink wine at 7 o'clock, I feel fabulous. If I drink it at 1:30 in the afternoon, I feel like I've had 20 Valium injected into my system. So learning how those rituals work, and even more important, Rick, in a sense, what those rituals mean. That is, when you have that kind of long lunch in Paris, what it really means is that somebody is offering you their friendship. They're offering you a certain kind of intimacy. In America, we depend a lot on quick hits and a kind of false intimacy. You're my friend. We call each other by our first names. All of that stuff happens very quickly. In France, it unfolds over a much greater period of time, and then it has much more adhesion as time goes on. Sharing a meal really means the beginnings of sharing a life.
I'll never forget once I was in France, and we were in Nice, and we were having this incredible meal, and it was completely accidental, I think, but everything was right. The food was right. The wine mm-hmm. was right. The camaraderie was right, and we were clearly energizing the whole corner of our restaurant. And I remember mm-hmm. the people at the next table told the waiter they wanted to drink the same wine we were drinking, thinking that was that was the trick. But it was more than just the wine.
A Meg Ryan moment. We'll have what they're having, right?
Yeah, we'll have what they're having. I mean, we were just, it was wonderful.
But don't you always think that that's the test of a great meal? I always like to say it's if the vectors point out that you suddenly have a strange feeling that the table has levitated in front of you through the combination of the things you eat and the people you're with. And one of the things that I don't like very often about fancy eating in America is that all the vectors seem to point inward. You have to focus on the red volcanic salt and the sea urchin foam on your plate at the expense of that exchange of social generosity, which I think is the real reason that we eat together, that I think is at the heart of the meaning of food.
You know, that's related to me to pretense. And I find myself when I'm working on my guidebooks and I find a good restaurant that may be expensive, but a great value, it's generally a place that I'll say, you know, great food, no pretense.
Isn't that what we're all looking for? I mean, it's funny, actually, you know, in France today, I don't know if you've come across them, there's a movement who call themselves, of all things, Le Fooding, who are trying to remake France, not so much in the image of America, but in the image of a faster and friendlier and more informal culture. They hate the pomposity of three-star dining. They want to have great French food, but they want to have it in a completely relaxed spirit. And they've sort of taken on the Michelin guide and they're publishing their own guide, which leaves out all those three-star temples.
I wonder if the French can be inspired by the Italians in that regard.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Don't you think that Italian food, in America at least, has become more kind of the lingua franca, the default case, the thing we're likeliest to cook or to eat when we go out? Exactly, because Italian food seems to be made by cooks rather than by chefs. It seems to be kind of natural expression of family life, of peasant life, if you like. And I think that's one of the things that's appealing about it. On the other hand, I don't know about you, but I still get an enormous thrill from the sheer artisanal expertise of a great French chef. You know, somebody who can produce a souffle or a proper, I haven't had beef Wellington in a long time, but the kind of thing that demands an expertise that you and I can't begin to share, there's a thrill in that too.
I'm speaking with Adam Gopnik, and Adam's new book is called The Table Comes First, Family, France, and the Meaning of Food. And Adam, you're talking about, in your book, you talked about how in France, modern cuisine is divided between molecular cooking, where there's sort of a chef with a lab coat, and then the slow food kind of cooking, which almost comes out of grandma's kitchen. Can you comment on that?
Right. I think that's a division we find not just in France, but right around the world now. You know, those molecular guys come particularly from Spain, but now in America, Nathan Myhrvold, of course, has published a $600 book just about it all. And they're all about kind of Willy Wonka stuff, transformation, take everything and turn it into something else. It's kind of a form of stage magic, really. And then the slow food movement, which I'm very sympathetic with, is all about restoring exactly the kind of the spirit of sustainable peasant eating. They're very, very different movements. And yet, you know what they have in common? It's exactly what we were talking about before. They're all about time. They're all about taking 4 hours to eat your magical molecular dinner. And they're all about taking 7 hours to braise your local lamb.
I've come out of a backpacker heritage and just, you know, kind of dorm food. It's horrible. And it's taken me a long time to warm up to the value of spending a lot of time and money eating. And just this last year, I've had this sort of revelation that, you know, you're spending $50 or $60 for a meal. It's not just nutrition. It's 3 hours of lavishing yourself with just sensuality and enjoying the ritual, enjoying the buildup, enjoying the conviviality. And I just took my notepad to a nice dinner in France, and I had so much fun just taking the opportunity to observe and appreciate all the fine points way beyond the menu that made that meal a beautiful 3 hours and $50 well spent.
Well, that's true, isn't it? The restaurant table is a form of theater. It's a theater that we all can enter, that we all sort of have to enter when we're on the road, especially every night. And if you see it as theater, if you see the waiters as the chorus and you see the chef as the hidden hero who you're only going to see at the end of the third act, then you really begin to enjoy it. It's a little theatrical representation of the country that you're visiting. Just the way the table we eat at home may not be theatrical in that same way, but it's very much the raft that we go down, family life all together.
Yeah. You know, you just hit it there for me because I'm thinking of my favorite meal in Italy recently, and it was in an enoteca, where you've just got a couple of small tables and a guy who loves the ingredients as they match up with the wine, and he takes a personal interest in your meal. And I find I'm drinking like way more than I normally drink. I'm eating for twice as long as I eat. And when I leave, I feel like I need a cigarette, even though I don't smoke. I mean, it's the most beautiful experience, that enoteca.
It's a wonderful way to eat, isn't it? You know, the thing you need at the end there is a double espresso, it seems to me. One of the things I think is true about eating is that it depends on the passage from wine to coffee, from spirits to caffeine. That's really what organizes our meals.
And then at the end, I've noticed there's almost like a celebration of chemistry and beakers and extra liquids that are all different kinds of fire water and sweet this and cookies. And it just keeps on going. They don't want to finish it.
That's the ritual of a good dinner, isn't it? You don't want to finish it.
Exactly. I'm Rick Steves. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're celebrating food with Adam Gopnik. And we know Adam from his book, Paris to the Moon. Adam's new book is The Table Comes First. Adam, you go way back in the history of this and have a wonderful kind of contagious fascination with the whole art and ritual of eating. And I love it when you're talking about the two R's, restaurants and recipe books. You mentioned something how the restaurant exists to coax women into having sex, and the recipe book is there to coax men into staying home. Tell us more about that.
Don't you think it's true? Well, one of the things that's true about restaurants from the time that the kind of modern restaurant, the kind we know now, first appeared in France right around 1780 and 1790, around the time of the French Revolution, is that they were always little theaters of romance, just the way they are today. The idea that one of the ways that you would try to woo somebody was to bring them to a meal where you would make choices, where you would show off your knowledge, your savoir-faire, your expertise. This is still the thing we do today. When you're turned on by somebody, what's the first thing you do? You ask them out to dinner. Or you take them home and you cook for them there. That was traditionally a much more feminine occupation, reading recipes and cooking. But blessedly, it's one that's become more and more ambisexual. I am actually the cook in our house. I do the cooking every night for our family. My wife was the daughter of a wonderful feminist mother who refused to teach her daughter to cook because she didn't want her to get imprisoned in the kitchen. My mother was an equally strong feminist who insisted on teaching her sons to cook because she wanted them to know what it was like to be imprisoned in the kitchen. Not to be imprisoned, but to be masterly to some degree in the kitchen.
Now, you wrote that both restaurants and recipe books are modern. How so?
Surprisingly, though, of course, people have been eating as long as there have been people and exchanging money for food as long as there's been money to exchange. The restaurant as we understand it now, the place where you go, you know, Rick, where you get a menu, your table is by itself. As I say, you're likely to use it to court somebody, has a certain kind of theatrical function that really only begins to appear around 1780 in Paris, around the beautiful Palais Royal. It's a new way of dining. You know, before that, you had what were called table d'hôte. We still use the word now, meaning big common tables where you had essentially everybody eating the same kind of thing. You can find restaurants like that in Spain and Greece even today. And that was a very different experience, a wonderful sense of communality, of course, but less of that sense of intimate exchange between you and the person you're dining with, and also between you and the chef, right? Because you have a kind of conversation with the chef when you're eating in a good restaurant. Choices you make, the things that are recommended. So that kind of intimate experience of choice and elevation that we associate with the restaurant, you really only begin to find that in Paris around 1790.
We're at 877-333-7425. And there's more Behind the Kitchen Door with Adam Gopnik. It's coming right up on Travel with Rick Steves. Travel with Rick Steves is made possible in part by the European Union delegation to the USA. Tips about traveling in Europe and information about the EU are available at euintheus.org.